Okay, I guess we're about ready to roll here. We're welcoming Karen Wall to talk to us about capitalizing the beauties, cultural institutions, tourism, and art in Alberta. And I need to begin with reminding us all, with the FOIP announcement, reminding us all that this is being recorded so that people can listen to it in the future through the Research Center site. So it's my great pleasure today to introduce Karen Wall, who is in communication studies at Athabasca University. As she writes, she seems to have taught and written courses in most fields called studies, including heritage, Canadian, women's, leisure, tourism, and cultural. Prior to academic life, she worked as an illustrator, printer, writer, theater set and prop builder, museum display artist, researcher, and photo archivist. She likes to think that all of these valuably inform her eclectic research interests into cultural phenomena under conditions of travel, migration, and social change, and other modes of transformation. Sorry, my eyesight isn't all it should be, and this print is very tiny. Recent research has focused on Alberta's cultural history and policy, First Nations cultures, and the production of environments dedicated to public memory. She's currently looking at how mobile media shape imagination and management of space and narrative in everyday urban life. So that's quite the mandate. I look forward to good things. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you, Leslie, and thanks for coming, everybody. And don't worry, I'm not going to talk about all of those things. I just wanted to have that background because it relates to my choice of topic in terms of cultural institutions and how people from different sectors of society have access to cultural institutions, have access to expression and so forth, and or do not. So just to start with, first I'll talk about a SHRC research project I've been working on with my colleague Pearl Ann Reichwein at the U of A for the past few years, off and on. And it's overall the history of the Banff School of Fine Arts, which hasn't actually been done. It's one of the wonderful things about researching Alberta cultural history. Practically nothing really relative to other places has been done in terms of really looking into Alberta cultural history. That's enough about that. So I'm calling this Capitalizing the Beauties, and I'll explain that in a bit. And what that does is point to the fact that tourism and art have tended to be to have integrated over the years. Number this won't be a huge surprise to anybody who's been following the political economy of culture in Alberta. But I think that some people who know maybe a little less about history in Alberta would be a little surprised to know that Alberta, for example, was the first jurisdiction in North America to pass a Cultural Development Act in 1946, and in fact has put lots of time, money, effort, and resources into actually developing culture for the public since the turn of the century. So this intrigued me, and partly I wanted to put it in the context of something that really caught my eye a few years ago, and that was 2007 when the Edmonton Art Gallery ran a show called Free for All, which was they opened the gallery to anybody who wanted to could come and hang their art or sculptures, whatever it was. Right? And they expected to have about 500 people, and in fact they got 3,000 people lined up around the block, as a newspaper report put it, with a public fervor akin to a Canadian Idol edition. Audiences, and then they had record attendance. The gallery had never seen so many people come through the doors from, quote, all walks of life rather than the, quote, upper crust. I've got a lot of quotes in here, so I'll just try to indicate it by tone rather than waving my fingers around. So I just thought this was wonderful. And it was like I've never seen so many people so thrilled about looking at art in all my entire life, if not in Edmonton, in any case. So I started thinking, well, you know, where do we go with this? So what I want to do in the presentation today is draw some of the ideas and some of the history of that cultural background in Alberta, and then take a huge jump to the present and say, is there any connection? I don't know. I'm not saying I have an answer, but I hope I can draw out some of the patterns. So my main interest, I guess, here is the integration of art and creativity into everyday life, into public spaces. So participation in culture, cultural democracy is what's driving this project. This is the images there. This is mostly images that I have. And I do a lot of analysis of images, historical photos, and graphics, arts, and so forth. It's a poster, obviously, of the Banff School of Fine Arts. And this is in around 1940. And you can see it looks very much like a tourist photo or a tourist ad. And the other is a tourist promotion sign, a tourism sign. Tourist facility shown thus, it says. I don't know if you can read that. You are here. And this is from Calgary, so it shows you how to get up to Edmonton. You know, if you go off the map a bit, you'll get to Edmonton. And eventually, if you go off the map a bit, you'll get to Banff. But I don't know if you can tell what this weird blurriness is here. But I really like the picture because I thought, it's a good symbol of what I'm doing here, because it's actually somebody's eyeglasses peering into the frame, trying to put a wonderful frame around Alberta and understand it all. So yes, that's why that's there. So the Banff School Project, looking at mostly the years between mid-30s to the end of the 1950s. And the Banff School, as you may know, started as a University of Alberta Extension project. So it's extension education, much as the Faculty of Extension still does today. I'm looking at this in the social historical context of what happens in Alberta society. As you go from a settler society based in agrarian mercantilism into an industrial wage-based economy, and then into post-war reconstruction development. I won't talk too much about that, but that context is important because it speaks to how people approached extension education, why people thought arts. I'm sorry, I'm having some voice problems, but we'll carry on. How people thought about arts, whether it has a public support, taxpayer support for arts education was constructed, and so forth. So first I'll talk a bit about that, arts and extension, arts education. I'll do an overview second of the Banff School as part of that circuit of culture that was producing the Banff Park and the National Parks and, by extension, the Canadian wilderness as a visual experience. I'll concentrate a little more on student experiences. In other words, here's what the state is giving you, here's what the university is giving you, here's what we expect of you as cultured citizens vis-a-vis what you're actually experiencing, what these people were actually experiencing. And after that, I'd like to move to ideas about the role of cultural institutions of the Edmonton Art Gallery, now the Alberta Gallery of Art, in society. Okay. So the art of the ordinary, culturing audiences and citizens. And that's a bit of a pun, culturing in the sense of nurturing and bringing along and pumping you full of culture at the same time, which is more or less what's going on. We're building audiences, we're training citizens in attitudes toward culture in cosmopolitan, metropolitan attitudes and so forth through extension education and these circuits of culture. So in looking at the Banff School, first thing that comes to mind is landscape, of course, the mountains. In this point, in the mid-century, you have landscape has a very interesting position in visual culture in Canada. It's common ground of the state, federal cultural agencies, tourism promoters, arts educators, the marketplace. It's very popular as souvenirs, home decor, and so on. It's also part of the construction of nature as a collection of quote-unquote beauty spots. So in other words, packaging nature through putting a frame around it through visual culture. Jody Berland, who's a Canadian cultural critic you might have read, actually put it, calls it, this is on the next slide, but the collection of magic images that speaks of our home and our identity. And here we're thinking about the group of seven and all those kinds of images. So you have the Banff glass we've seen in this national context. You have the National Gallery of Canada institutionalizing this quote-unquote national landscape style, basically defined as group of seven and others that they've decided is a definitive Canadian style. If corporate sponsorship of the gallery's program to distribute reproductions to schools, doctor's offices, radio, television programs, et cetera, et cetera. And one of these corporate sponsors specified, we will support only, quote, wholesome, understandable pictures, by which they meant basically landscape. Because the bigger concept of this is, and this is one thing that really intrigued me about this study, is this was the 40s and 50s are the first decades of the fine arts program at the Banff School. All around, in the art world, you have, of course, abstract expressionism, all kinds of modern art, experimental art, and so on. But here we have a focus on landscape. Well, why is this? So who's this a native? So the shaping of iconic images going on by the federal elites, by provincial, regional elites, and this is art societies, teachers, and so forth. It's a very interesting influence because by the 1950s you've had successful community arts programs. Out in the villages and the towns and the community halls, you have all kinds of people studying to paint. Usually they're painting landscapes, still life portraits, and so on. Huge success. People are very interested. If an art show, and they send these art shows all around so all the other people in all the other towns and cities can see what everybody's doing. And people just flock out to these things. It's like the thing I was talking about at the gallery. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we're producing sophisticated professional artists. There's a definite audience. We want to build audience, living in their parents' basements. So there's this definite distinction. And I'll just give you one. The school used to show at the U of A campus here, the parent campus, would always have a show of the summer students in the fall. And the University Gateway newspaper, they'd always go and review it. And if you're reading over these things over the decades, you really get the impression, of a very strong public pressure for acceptance. And for example, 1944 show, thank goodness there was an absence of the ultra-modern school conglomeration of light bulbs, eyeballs, screwdrivers, fried eggs, and bridges, thrown together and rendered in colors revolting to the eye. The director, Donald Cameron, who is a very, very powerful figure, also happened to have a real fondness for traditional art. We will reject the grotesque type of paintings. Only art with universal appeal should come out of the school. So this is a photo of a publicity photo, of course, of a couple of students at the school. But one thing that's interesting that I found about these reviews is that often the reviewer would link the realism. That's what people would praise, the realism of the landscapes, but not just the realism of, photorealism, but how much did it match up with the tourist images that they'd seen or the tourist experiences that they've had. So one person is, quote, delighted to find that this realistic painter's mountains are our mountains too, so faithful to nature that you can, in imagination, join the party of tourists and again experience the thrill of remote grandeur. So, and there's constant references to cheerful images and sarcastic dismissals if somebody has, a gray picture of a mountain in the rain, because as we all know, that never happens in the mountains. So, meanwhile, The University of Alberta president, who's Robert Newton at this point, is praising the school by the early 40s, and you've only had art classes there for about 7 years at this point. And he said, well, Banff School will capitalize the beauties of the park across the country. So he's an educator, and you know, they're all, you know, in the fine arts departments and the arts and humanities, but it's never far from anybody's mind what a valuable attraction this school will be for tourists and also just to send the images of the province out there. Oh, and this quote from Alberta Economic Development, I'm a little bit ahead of myself here, but the Alberta Economic Development Department annual report had it in 1946 has a large section of apparently quotes from farmers who are unidentified and, you know, local people, rural people, who come and say things like, yep, now that we're all, and you can just hear this, the accent, now that we've about got the fields all licked, it's time to start homesteading the cultural field. And you can, you know, and which I have no doubt in my mind that ordinary people walked around saying that. So what I'm basically getting at here is you have this this whole culture, which is created in part by the state, by education, by cultural institutions, in creating audiences, creating tourists, creating consumers, basically, for the national parks as well as for art. As early as the 1930s, the Canadian Hosteling Movement, which got started in Alberta, the Gateway Reviews, a trip that they take to Banff, the system of, quote, foolproof and beautified trails through beautiful mountain and forest scenery, and they say beautiful about four times in the sentence, but I just have a few excerpts, where, quote, nothing in the world can harm you, and there are good compositions in every direction for photographers. So this is, you know, fairly early on in the tourism experience. But what are they emphasizing? They're emphasizing access, they're emphasizing views and capturing the views, taking the views. Oh, and here's the Berlin quote here. So what I started to look at was the way that the school uses the same imagery resources of the mountains, of certain views, of certain selected beauty spots as location painting spots. So students essentially are buying the opportunity to go to these certain locations which they know in advance because they're famous mountain beauty spots, as they keep calling them. And and these will be the same sites that the CPR has long sponsored artists to go and paint. The CPR donates to the school in the 30s and later directly purchases students' artworks. So they're not purchasing anything except landscapes that will be good for tourist display, for advertising, and so on. The National Gallery I've already talked about, but they're in collaboration with the Parks Branch, developing souvenirs, retail lectures, hoping to buy student work because it's cheap and they can use it. The Canadian Park Association, the CFB, the NFB, they're all boosting the school and the park virtually in the same breath and using the same imagery. The school also collaborates with the Alberta Tourism Board, the Canadian Tourism Board, CPR, of course, to promote the school as a tourist attraction. And this is rather an interesting quote from the director of the school, Donald Cameron, and here's a typical cheerful tourist painting. Here's a collection of postcards, and you can see that it's in the same image collection. The school put exhibits out on the streets of the town during the summers as well. So they were very much a tourist attraction. But Cameron says, he writes this actually in a memo, in 1949, the federal government is very anxious to develop the capacity of Jasper National Park for tourism. So what they wanted to do is extend painting classes there because then you'd have a choice, quote, a choice of locations unequaled in the world. So it's like building a repertoire of these these particular images, and he says, we owe the Rocky Mountains such a lot. So many artists want to paint the mountains, and there's such a stretch of them, which sounds, you know, very, very commodity-oriented kind of remark for the director of an art school. So there's a lot more material along those lines that I've been looking at, but I became interested in asking whether, okay, the school had, they offered credit courses, university courses, and non-credit courses, which drew a certain kind of people there. At first, the students are mainly, well, they're mainly women all through this period. But school teachers from little towns, people who want to go back and be art teachers, some hobbyists, but there's a real focus on the fact that we're not just going here to goof off and, you know, paint pictures. We're going to get some credentials from this. And one of the reasons, of course, at this point in extension education that the government is supporting this, that we're getting public funding put into this, is because we're going to have these people disseminate into the towns, start art clubs, run art classes, teach people, teach kids, and so forth, and we'll have a cultured population. So even though now, of course, the Banff Center attracts professionals and elite artists from all over the world, at this time it's very much an amateur student kind of organization. So knowing students as one does, one wonders how much of this ideology they're actually imbibing as they leave, you know, their various places. Maybe they've never been out of their town or off of their farm, a lot of them haven't, and go off to this fabulous destination for a wonderful vacation and don't have to help with the harvest for a change. You know, and there's lots of references to this kind of thing in student letters. I'm just trying to jump ahead a bit. The CBC and the NFB at this point they're both doing documentaries and broadcasts on the Banff School and promoting it. And what they're doing is, because the school is competing not only with other tourist destinations and attractions, but with other summer art schools. At this point in North America, there are many, many summer art schools going on all over the place. Which I wasn't aware of. This was in the 40s and 50s. And so they're competing with those. And so CBC 1950s, it's a haven of rest from the hurly-burly of life, a holiday in one of the most renowned beauty spots of the world with a little learning thrown in. The NFB says, there's little chance of, you have to imagine those wonderful old CBC and NFB voices, little chance of either Jack or Jill becoming dull if they enroll from too much work. The program is one of equal rights to both work and play. And the students say, the students are saying, well, an ideal art course should be, quote, sightseeing, holidaying, with perhaps a bit of painting thrown in. On location, some paint, some pen, some borrow cigarettes from name of incredibly famous Canadian artist with whom they're hanging around. You know. So the artists are also tourist attractions. But meanwhile, the school has to keep a balance. First of all, it's answerable to the U of A and its credentials and so on. Also, its cultural capital depends on being a real, a genuine art school and not just a place for dabblers to go. Because what we're trying to do here, although the administration and the promo keeps emphasizing that these are very ordinary people. They just wandered in from little towns and villages and hamlets. Here we're quoting a journalist from the Montreal Star in the 50s. They just happen to wander in from all these places, just hoping to keep their minds from stagnating and learn some useful skills, and which, you know, a few of them were, but it wasn't quite that romantic either. So the school, meanwhile, is emphasizing they're not just buying postcards. Instead of buying postcards, they paint the scene themselves. So in other words, you're tourists. So the students have this hybrid status. They're tourists, they're artists. They're cultural consumers, they're cultural producers at the same time. And they're sent out on location painting. So the 1952 CBC radio says, four walls can't contain the talent and energy which converges annually on the mountain resort so it bubbles over the whole town and adjacent countryside. When in fact location painting was a center of great debate, some concerned debate among administration, the teachers who were very important and, you know, experienced artists. And that's another thing Cameron was trying to do. You have this contrast between the citizens, the quote-unquote ordinary citizens who were not trained in art, who were not sophisticated in art, and the rhetoric of serving the public and all of that sort of thing. But meanwhile, very strong push from the administration to build a world-class art institution that brought in, there's quotes like, you know, the top-notch artist who sounds like a roll call of the Royal Canadian Academy, and, you know, all the cultured leaders from around the world. So you have you know, a lot of potential for clashes going on here in the mountains. So students come, they expect, you know, to paint some pretty pictures. The teachers, and these are all reports from student newsletters and journals and so on. The first thing they said to us was, forget about painting pretty pictures to send home. They sent us out on location to achieve the visceral experience of nature. So you are painting landscapes, but not quite in the way you thought you were going to be, because you're being taught by serious artists that really want you to think about expressing, you know, your experience and not just making copies and postcards. The turbulence of the water, capture the mood. One young woman, 1947, she's from a farm in Saskatchewan, and she's just horrified, and she wrote about this in her journal. You get no instruction. You're just sent out there with your oil paint to paint like the group of seven. But the mountains are huge, right? The mountains are looming over me, and I can't do it. Who can do it? Who can just go out there and, like, paint the mountains? It's too much. I really just want to paint flowers and small, you know, accessible. But no, I'm told that's not what an artist does. So somebody else comes along and says, who wants to go to a university hedged in by towering mountains? There are no movie theaters. There's not. It's just so completely claustrophobic. So you have all of this rhetoric of how being in the mountains is so sublime, and it's going to uplift your abilities and all those romanticist ideas about what art does and what nature does. And they're just not experiencing it. There also is some abstract expressionism. A lot of the instructors just want to work in the studio to keep you from just doing vacation dabbling, as they call it. One student says, his great production center of weird abstraction, I think they're talking about this fellow here, drove students to scale the pinnacle of art, i.e. rather than real pinnacles, away from the naturalistic objective compulsions of the mountain environment. So in other words, you're in the mountains, but painting the mountains in a way is a bit of a defeat, you know, if you're really going to get the most out of art school. And it's the same with their experience as tourists. Again and again, they're being told, you know, what a wonderful privilege it is for them to be tourists in the mountains, and they're being encouraged to go out and be well-balanced and recreation and so forth, and they're just constantly complaining about this unusual fresh air existence is going to make men out of us, or we'll be going home to take a vacation. You know, and all kinds of sarcastic accounts of going out on painting expeditions. Through persistent and dogged efforts, we finally reached the summit. Stewed and weakened, the 23 of us devoured the 5 sandwiches we brought along. Our appetites thus satisfied, we began the perilous descent, looking upon beauty without ceasing, pausing only to gaze rapturously at the magnificent panorama below. So all through these student works and writings and so on, they're just, of course, engaged in what students are always doing, which is partly taking it all in and thinking in new and different ways, but also undermining the ideologies and the pedagogy and making fun of their instructors and so forth. So I hate to break it to you, but students actually, they do that. I think I'd like to jump ahead into the present now, but there is another theme in this study is part of the gender. And students were also tourist attractions, because pictures of those wonderful scenes with people doing cultural things in them were actually, you know, a real one of the assets, one of the great advertising resources of the school. So this is all school advertising material, except for this, which is from the 1920s. It's Bathing Beauties in Jasper somewhere. So, I mean, there's this tradition, right? But these young women are, of course, put in those exact same kind of cheesecake photos. And one of them, actually, the women complain. There are far less men here than I assumed when I was lured by the lavishly illustrated calendar. This is an example of a calendar. Actually, there's hardly any men when they get there on their own. But anyway, so that's basically what with the, and of course, there's a lot more to that. But the idea of trying to kind of disperse cultural learning and so on out to the citizenry and what they do with it, you know, two different things. So I'm thinking to myself, well, you have all of these decades, all of these people, you know, not just at the Banff School, but all kinds of extension learning all over the province. And they're painting pictures and they're drawing and they're doing artistic things. And where is all this stuff? Is it all in your mother's basement again? Or is it, you know, in the closet somewhere? Or did you give it to your kid? Or where is it? I mean, we don't see it, right? Because of that. Of course, I'm looking at the distinction between professional and amateur art and what gets into the walls of cultural institutions. Okay. So my theory is it all ends up in this exhibition in 2007. I won't take you through the whole history of the Edmonton Art Gallery, but these pictures on the left, of course, it's also, education is a very important part of the Art Gallery's mandate, public education, also extension classes. We don't hear a lot about that now, but this is the case, and so this is some of the art that was going on there back in, I guess, probably the 40s. All through the membership rate was 0.15% of the population, and maybe 10% of the population who actually bought tickets and went to the gallery. And it's been more or less constant, but their highest revenue source has been extension classes. So obviously people are interested in making things, people are interested in doing art. Are they necessarily interested in looking at what they're told they should be looking at? The gallery really loses a lot of public credibility and interest during the 70s and 80s because of its concentration on kind of New York style abstract expressionism. Nobody's interested. Not even a lot of the local artists. A lot of the local artists are quite peeved as well because some of them are painting different, you know, they can't get in. And that resentment carries over to today, as we'll see. So are we moving from, art for some, and of course this is a reference to the art for all ideals of early extension education. Or back to this exhibit, the free-for-all exhibit. And you can see floor to ceiling, wall to wall, as the critic says. It's dizzying to see the enthusiasm Edmontonians have for their creative urges. And these are what I did was look at responses, letters to the editor, critics, blogs, and so forth, from about 2005 to the present. The sheer excess of visual stimulation was the real gem. The success of the show is, quote, a direct reflection of the citizens' work and the community's response to support their own. The gallery is unusually energetic and alive compared to most times when patrons are few and far between. So, of course, the reviews are about, I mean, they're not going to review the individual art pieces. Just as at the Banff School of Fine Arts, you never got a review of the individual art or the quality of the individual paintings or painters. You always got it. How this fits into our, you know, our growing cultural development, how this promotes our landscapes, our Canadian visual culture. The participants, I did some interviews there on while I was there, and also some texts. Two things come out, access and legitimation. I'd never been in this place before. I never felt comfortable coming to this place before, variations on this. And I've never taken a lesson. This is one thing you heard over and over again. I'm completely self-taught. I've never taken a lesson. I never thought, you know, I'd ever be in this art gallery. and I never wanted to be in the art gallery before. I never had the interest. Or, you know, as Bourdieu, for example, has the, I forget what the exact phrase is, but, you know, kind of the self-policing, the self-categorizing of, am I the kind of person that goes to the art gallery? Well, no. So, so the same themes seem to be developing. You know, this is what we're interested in, and we're just not coming out unless we see it. One of the things I'm interested in is not art as an instrumental vehicle for economic development or even social development or and social cohesion. We're interested in art as a communicative environment. We're interested in art as exchange, as a point, you know, that we have in common, which is creativity in everyday life. Okay, so then we get quite a lot of critique about this, and quite a lot of it from actually professional artists. And one of them, named Mark Country, I'll just read his quote because it kind of sums up the general resentment and the tone of objection. In a last-ditch effort to program something, anything, before the, this is the last show before they tore it down to build a new one, before the wrecking ball comes, they are leaving it up to you, dear citizen, to do it for them. They've given up the whole thinking and choosing thing, and presumably the paying artist these things. A couple of others are critical of the actual work and so forth. But so it comes down to, you know, the question, and you get this question at debates on, you know, internet exhibitions and internet works and this sort of thing, because it does expand access so much. You know, if we have so many people creating so much and posting so much and exhibiting so much and anyone can do it, then of course, you know, you have the question of mediocrity. So we get back to those other debates in art speak. But I think part of the great delight in the whole free-for-all exhibition was the dissonance, the unexpected, you know, going in there and seeing that instead of what you'd usually see. And just one quote, creating a gallery based on inclusivity is in some sense creating a space that's already doomed to fail according to a certain set of standards. The underlying paradoxical democracy negating idea is that if a space lets everybody in, nobody will want to be there. I think Groucho Marx actually said that. And I just thought I'd put that next to somebody's drawing of house because it sounds like something he would say as well. So given that response and the stated objective of the gallery in putting that show on, which was to see what the public really wants, to judge the visceral, you know, love of the public for arts, and they put all kinds of press releases out to this effect, you would think when they opened the new gallery that what would be the first thing you would do? You'd have another free-for-all show, but no. No, of course you wouldn't, because that's not what's going on here. And the original question I had here was, when is a sports stadium not a sports stadium? When it's a world-class art gallery. So this critique around this that I'm sure you'll be familiar with from, you know, current discourse on cities, globalization, intercity competition, and so forth, the development of creative cities. Some people are creative, and those are the moving, flexible, mobile people. Some people are obviously, in comparison, not creative, and those would be the quote-unquote ordinary people. So you have Stephen Harper saying, ordinary people aren't interested in art. You know, it's only those art snobs are out there, you know, dancing at galas and so forth. And, of course, there's Ralph Klein talking about severely normal Albertans. So what's ordinary and severely normal? Are those codes for working class? You know, at some points in some eras, you know, some contexts of criticism, yes, that's what it is. I think it's a bit more in this particular context. And I think we can generally put that under the category of non-creative people. So in other words, some people are, some people aren't, which, of course, I'm arguing intensely against, which we all know from experience. As Raymond Williams said, you know, they were saying that back in the 50s and 60s in England. You know, some people are creative, they're creative, there's no popular culture left, everything's being destroyed by the mass media, etc. That's not what I see. You know, I see all around me, I see people being creative. So what does this all mean? So again, when we're building the AGA, again, a lot of huge public interest in the design, a lot of public support, a lot of money being raised. And then there's a big economic boom and costs rise 55%. Well, the public's attitude toward art tends to, okay, art stands for, of course, a certain kind of class experience, a certain, in this case, a certain sector of society that we are maybe not identifying with. So accountability, the choice between public goods, quotes from the journal, again, mostly. It's a waste of money for people with nothing else to do, not the working stiff. It's rich people's entertainment, ignoring the basic needs of the underprivileged. Why do we need this gallery? Because the wealthy upper crust are bored with their easy lives and need new toys and diversions. And there they all are at the opening. And it's a white elephant, which is a phrase you constantly hear these days about these kinds of institutions. Hold the works of a select few protected by an even smaller elite group, not for the vast majority of people who will never set foot in it. And then we have the positive responses. And out of all the positive responses, only two were about education. One was from the education director of the gallery, and one was from someone at the U of A on the faculty at the U of A who were promoting, yes, but they're going to have a more educational facility. Almost everybody else is speaking in creative city development kind of terms, and summed up nicely by Daryl Cates, who says, this art gallery will bring new life to our downtown. And we all know Daryl Cates is very interested in developing, getting into downtown life. So, and the Sun newspaper poll, after the director and the mayor and various luminaries claimed that this isn't just for art lovers, for rich art lovers and art snobs, it's for everybody because it will bring more workers, it'll attract workers, it'll attract investment, you know, our quality of life will be better. So the Edmonton Sun does a poll. Do you believe that the gallery is a magnet to attract workers and residents to the city? 86% say, no, that's silly. 6% say, yes, Alberta Labor loves art. So you have a real kind of division, you know, you have outlines of the culture wars going on here, which is not surprising, but as Paula Simons put it, we have to ask why more Albertans have not understood public funding for the arts contributes to the quality of our lives. Well, that's a good question, because Albertans have been told this in one way or another by governments since the 1920s, if you look in terms of access to arts education, and et cetera. It just does not seem to have sunk in, which suggests that there's some skepticism about the mandate and the overall goal. And I just like this other quote, you know, because it just comes back to people are... Our creative people are always making art. Once in a lifetime, they get to put it into a public institution, and you know, then we get a sign of it. And these are, of course, what the gallery opens with instead of opening with any local art, professional or amateur, Degas and Goya. This wasn't actually in there, but it was a series of etchings. But it went nicely with the wine and cheese remark, I thought, and the Carsh exhibit. We can discuss that later, but you know, I hope it's obvious that I'm not complaining about people getting to go see the chance to see Goya and et cetera. And good thing, those are good things for us to see. However, the question is, what choices do we have? So just to sum up, Raymond Williams, well-known quote, culture's ordinary. And it's a paraphrase that Margaret Atwood writes back to an open letter to Stephen Harper saying, the country is full of people going to creative writing classes and art classes, and you know, arts events far outsell sports events. And in fact, you're the one who is abnormal, Mr. Harper. His creativity actually is ordinary. That's the whole point of it. And here I've just put I just kind of like to move into, you know, any ideas people might have about you know how we do see creativity. Out on the streets, outside the institutions. Here we have, this is actually the Pride Parade, or the Pride Festival last year, which is an interesting example of now a publicly sanctioned and funded, organized festival, which of course came from the grassroots sector. the folk festival, which, like art, has been over the course of the last couple of hundred years, you know, brought into the distinctions of mass, popular, professional, amateur culture. A lot of people listening, not too many people playing, but not complaining about the folk festival either. This is, and of course you have activism, a lot of creativity going into activism, polar bear costumes, and the other. This is, I believe, a protest about Aboriginal education funding. So to finish up, what I'm moving into is looking at what's being called maker culture these days, and going back to William's ideas of a do-it-yourself culture in all kinds of areas. This is, and you know, again, on the internet, but also in reaction to technology, technology both in terms of, you know, actual machinery such as the internet, but also the technology of monopolies of knowledge and so on, people making actual things. So art in passing, this is what I'm interested in looking at now, both in terms of art made in transit, whether it's through mobile technologies, internet, mobile devices and so on, or just things people put together that are either transient in themselves or that people just have to be passing by and doing. So this is New Orleans, somebody's just hanging up there. And this is somebody, I don't know what the shoes have to do with. I guess it's injury claims. But it's interesting because I'm also looking at pilgrimage spots where people leave their crutches, where people put their prayers in little little tags on statues and so forth. This is a cemetery in Paris, and this is Modigliani's grave, and somebody's done a little portrait of him and made an installation. Sevastopol, people made their own graves there. Of course, it's a Soviet military site. So disused, the cemetery is full of old missiles and things people have made into decorations for the tombs. New Mexico is just full of people making art on the roadside out of junk. This is my front yard. I had a big iron sculpture there. Very abstract. I kind of, we called it the wrecked car, but there it was, and it could fit in with anything really in this little old Allendale neighborhood. But one day we came out and somebody in the night had come along and taken my neighbor a couple houses down, had these ceramic bunnies out in her little front garden, and they decided this thing, and it looks like a little altar, a little thing. It would just be much better with a ceramic bunny. So they came and they moved it, you know, because that just, and really it suited. We left it there. We thought it was pretty good. Pilgrimage spot in Chimayo, New Mexico, prayers tied. Kiev, this is as kind of a secular pilgrimage place where lovers go and tie their love wishes on this bridge, and then they kiss. Sasha and Julia equal love. Rome speaking statue, people for centuries have put what they want to say on there as they went by. And New Mexico, again, skulls. And this is Checkpoint Charlie in Berlin, and there was something going on, people were piling flowers. So you can ask yourself, are these things art? And that is the whole point. So, sorry, I've gone on a bit long, but I'll stop now, and thank you very much, and we can go to questions.
Well, thanks, Karen, for the provocative assemblage of many things to think about here, and I guess first we'll ask if there are any questions of the one person who is off-site. And if not, then I open the floor to questions or comments or whatever from the group here.
Angela? Thanks, Karen. I thought that was really provocative. I'm wondering if you're making a distinction between creativity, art, and good art. Because frankly, I think, this is my own personal opinion, having people put their things that they've hauled out of the basement or their closets and putting it in the art gallery, to me, is somewhat inappropriate, simply because I think it just kind of emphasizes or draws attention to sort of the very incredibly pedestrian attitude that we have towards art in this province, even in this country. So I'm just wondering if you're making a distinction. And sorry if I sound kind of like an art snob, but I sort of agree with Adorno to some degree about what constitutes art. Or good art.
And yes, that's a very good question. And of course, I thought about this you know, quite a bit, and we'll go on thinking about it as people before and since Adorno have been making themselves crazy and in art speak theory. But yes, and I come from the art snob faction myself, as having gone to art school and been through all the whole art speak thing and worked in the field and have lots of professional artists as friends. And I certainly see that point of view, and yes, we need to see excellent work, and yes, we professional artists need government subsidies, and I'm not arguing against that at all, and we need to see high culture, the best that has been done, etc. But and creativity, I'm looking at visual arts as a particular instance, but I'm not limiting creativity to that. There's, it happens that some kinds of creativity can be captured in, you know, who is it, Baudrillard, I think, calls the museum an apparatus of capture, you know, where you're just intensifying kind of the consumer experience, and he talks about locusts swarming, overlooking at everything, and just a cultural spectacle. But there are still, of course, there are always those, you know, the romantic experiences of art and so on. All of those that come, all of those ideas that come into arts education and rationales for public arts fundings and so on, all of those are valid, and we need those. But I guess what I'm looking at is areas where people who are engaged in creativity for its own sake, what kind of outlets do they have? Maybe they're just making really bad art because that's all the opportunity, you know, that they've had, you know. So are our public spaces open for people to go out and just be creative doing performance or building strange little Inukshuk things or painting on the sides of buildings? You know, they're not. It's constrained. So that's what I'm most interested in. It's just that there is creativity out there. Some is defined as art, and some, you know. And what I'm saying is we need both. We need to know about both. Yes, Paul.
I wanted to ask a question about reproduction, because as you went through it, it seemed that like a lot of the public creative art that was done in the 30s and 40s was fairly reproductive of the vision that was ascribed by the authorities. It seemed to fit in terms of the landscaping and almost the consumer quality of it, reproducing, you know, images of the mountains and that kind of thing. But as you went more to the present, it seemed to change, and there was a less of a reproductive quality to it, even more of a kind of, I wouldn't say radical, that's maybe too, but they have this, you know, this our good friend in Redyard, Jim Martin, said this term of the radical domestic, mm-hmm. how people in ordinary creativity can actually undermine some, in everyday creative activities, undermine the way in which collective mainstream norms are being reproduce. So there seemed to be in those last shots a much more sort of almost non-reproductive quality.
Which ones are you thinking of?
The ones that you're going through in the end there.
Ones
where,
yeah.
Where people are seeing something different than simply reproducing the yes. national vision.
Yes, and these would come into the category of outsider art, folk art, and so on. And a lot of work being done in that area as well. But This is what I'm more interested in. This goes back to Angela's comment too. Things people are doing not because they're calling them art. They're doing them because they see something that needs doing. You know, something calls to them. They envision something and they make it so. You know, that's creativity in all kinds of different areas. You do it with the materials that you have to hand. You know, so that's what I'm interested in here. But actually, the landscape thing's interesting because Alberta was, you know, people went on producing landscapes, being interested in landscapes, and teaching landscapes in Alberta for a long time after the vogue for landscape had actually faded in other places. So it wasn't until at least the 70s that abstract art and other kinds of art actually became, you know, more accepted here.
Just on that note of abstract expressionism, I've heard rumors that Clement Greenberg came to Edmonton and really, really liked what they were doing at the U of A in terms of abstract expressionism. So they kept doing it and doing it and doing it because Clement Greenberg said it was really great stuff way past the expiry date for abstract expressionism. So it's kind of interesting to see, you know, somebody gloms onto something, whether it's, you know, reproducing landscape art or doing this wacky abstract expressionism that nobody understands but Clement Greenberg. Rosenberg says it's good, so therefore we should continue to do it, and therefore it's great art. So it's just an interesting sort of side thing about how critics can influence what kind of art you're going to produce.
Greenberg was incredibly influential here, of course. And he had ideas about the flatness of the prairies and pure form and things like that. But he also went to Emma Lake, and he was so excited because he went in and said, "Here," and they're much more concentrated on abstracts and that sort of thing than they did at the Banff School, but goes in and says something to the effect of, "This is so wonderful. There's all this beautiful country all around, and you're ignoring it. You know, this is a wonderful thing for him." Rihanna?
Yeah, that was a great talk, Karen. I know you hinted a little bit about the gender stuff, and I was really struck, certainly in the earlier historic photographs of the young women, and I can't help but suggest that I'm sure that in the, you know, the Donald Cameron quotes about capitalizing on the beauties, obviously this links between nature, the feminine nature, and of course, beautiful women. You mentioned that a lot of women coming to take these courses, and then being disappointed because there weren't any men. But I'm wondering if you could say a bit more about these women who came, and clearly they were resistant in some way to what they're being presented, which is interesting. But was there kind of a cultivation? I mean, like why were they coming? What was the kind of emphasis that made it on women? I'm just curious.
Well, first and foremost, it's because there was, as I said, there was a rationale to come, which was for the credentials for school teaching. And, of course, most school teachers, the great majority, were women. So that was one thing. Another thing was because of the rural mix of students. A lot of men were just needed on the farm, physical labor at that time. Even though the school wasn't really aimed, I mean, despite, you know, they talked a good game, but they did not really advertise. They didn't advertise in the UFA newsletter. They held their classes at harvest time, etc. And, of course, this was just, you have to remember, this is just in the early, like, 40s into the 50s. And gradually the school attracted, you know, more people, more interested in art as a profession, who actually did go and do art as a profession and came from all over the place and so forth. But one thing is just as interesting is that it's this constant tension between, you know, we're an art school, we're expressing ourselves, we're artists, there's the natural sublime. There are all those wonderful ideas of freedom and, you know, creativity and so on going on. But because of the institution, because it's a metropolitan institution of education, higher education, you've got, for instance, the students come and they're always saying, "Oh, I thought famous artists were going to be all eccentric and, you know, all messy and full." Well, of course they weren't. They were in their suits and ties, you know, at all times, because they were university professors, and don't you forget it. And these are all, of course, posed sites. There's one woman is talking about, she was out painting, and the school or the publicity photographer came, and the teacher, I think it was Walter Phillips, is very traditional British kind of watercolorist, made her cover her legs because they were all covered in oil paints, but this woman's weren't, so they got into the picture. But, you know, you don't want to give the parents, you don't want to give the authorities the idea that they're these young women, you know, bohemians and just running wild in the wilderness. You know, we have very strict disciplinary boundaries. And I have another whole section on Aboriginal people and their relationship to school. Alvin.
Yeah, one thing you mentioned was this notion that art had to be wholesome, and I wonder if you could comment in terms of how this fit in generally with government policies in that period, because just thinking in terms of social credit government, which was paranoid, Cold War, and I mean, very prone to censorship. I mean, this is the province where nobody got to see the Black Bear Jungle until the CBC presented it in 1963, and even then, there were several months of debate before the CBC presented it because the Alberta government was trying to prevent it from being broadcast in Alberta, where it was banned. This kind of stuff. This must have had some effect on the Banff School.
Yeah, definitely, and because they were dependent on public funding through the university. Through the university as well, the Edmonton Art Gallery wouldn't show, you know, in the 60s still, it wouldn't show, you know, art that was, you know, that had a theme, any kind of sexual theme that could, because although I have to say, you know, the National Gallery is much more progressive and eclectic in its collections. It wasn't limited at all to, you know, to Canadian style landscape. And the Edmonton Art Gallery is also, you know, quite, they had people working there who were very interested in modern art, what's going on, but they weren't about to show it to the population because it would jeopardize their funding. But the wholesome thing, actually, I gave a paper a while ago on that theme, just on the theme of wholesome, because around the same time, I think the 30s, during the Depression, and of course the Works movement in the United States, the person who was the head of it, this really struck me, I've just remembered it, says all of the work there are artists produce for the public should be wholesome. It should give you the same feeling as eating a fresh ear of corn. So, you know, and of course it goes into the post-war reconstruction and the Massey Commission, all the beginning of, you know, state cultural policy that is really connected to ideas of, well, we just had these horrible wars and now we're reconstructing, and we're promoting the best of civilization because we've just gone through all this hell to save it. Right? So what's it for? We're going to have culture. We're going to have, you know, it's gone in Europe. And there was this sense, of course, you know, that Europe was devastated and it was up to North America now, you know, for a while too. So that all kind of goes into it. But we don't want a populace full of Europeans because, on the other hand, you know who Europeans are too. You know, so we, you know, we're going to not censorship exactly, but strong, and they did teach abstract art, and they did exhibit it, but there's strong either disapproval, basically. So it's the kind of, I'll just stop now. Leslie?
Yeah, I wanted to sort of, as you were talking about the free-for-all exhibit, I thought about sort of several kind of democratized fora for art more recently, including the Strathcona Art Walk, which I actually wandered around at for the first time ever last year and looked at sort of what was out there. And things like Flickr, where they have watercolor and oil paint and acrylic groups of various sorts out there, you know, in terms of sort of places like democratic venues for culture. I was just kind of wondering how you might reflect on those.
Yes, it's... The idea of uncurated exhibitions is actually has been growing over, you know, the past decade at least in Canada. There were several scheduled in the early 2000s in Alberta, Calgary, Edmonton, various places at some of the major institutions, all of which withdrew because they anticipated no ticket revenue. So the internet has actually become one of the great sites of uncurated exhibitions, but they're also, and this is, you know, the problem in a recession, for example, you get spaces emptying. A lot of cities are using empty spaces, the landlords, empty retail spaces, the landlords will open them up for people to put in exhibitions and this kind of thing, or they'll take over disused factories and warehouses. And so this is a really interesting thing that's coming out of the current current situation. But with the whole, you know, the idea of do-it-yourself or maker culture, there's a real, and I think, you know, again, the internet is very, of course, very influential in this, you know, the idea of access. It's just there's a whole generation that has more or less grown up with this idea. I have access to see whatever I want, I have access to put my version out there or say, you know, say what it is about it. And this has got to be having some effect. So this is what I want to look at. How that might be influencing things that are going on out in the material world as well, and that kind of interaction between. Yeah. But no, it's, and I've just been reading actually in the C magazine, I think yesterday, that a woman, I think it's an Aboriginal woman out in Spruce Grove, has started bringing out the, starting up again community art classes, which I didn't really talk about, but that were very effective in the UK in the 60s, 70s, I think. But anyway, so just having a space where people can come and just do art and talk, but it's a social thing, you know. And yeah, I really don't like looking at bad art, you know. But at the same time, it gives me this, you know, and I'm saying this is, it's not just me. I mean, I think this is kind of, you know, a lot of people have this, you know, I think I know what good art is because it's the art that, I like. But I like it with one part of my head, right? then there's the other stuff that you find at the Value Village that you can see someone's fingerprints all over, and it's this joyful kind of feeling, you know, somebody just loved this thing, whatever it was, you know, and I have this whole garage full of this stuff because I just can't leave it there, because and I just think a lot of people feel that way. I mean, we can love different things for different qualities, you know, but I think the important thing is I'm just really interested in all of these kinds of community movements that are going on to just say, well, you know, the heck with it, let's get together and do this.
I was just going to say there's some interesting reflections on the aesthetics, getting back to Angela's comment, of the art that you find in these uncurated spaces. And some of it is quite banal, even if there's relative skill in its execution. Some of it fits into the genre that my sister cheerfully refers to as motel art. Mm-hmm. And some of it is brilliant, you know, and it's just kind of all in there together.
The distinction between bad and good art is different from the distinction of reproduction, because even in the Adorno thing, not all lead art is autonomous in the Adorno sense, where it actually can subvert forms that are reproductive. So it's a bit misleading to think that experimental art has any kind of radical value. Whereas you can see in some, especially in the new social movements, when you get to activist communities producing, there does have some radical value, even though it may not be technically good art in that kind of formal distinction. But yet it has a subversive quality to it, because it's part of a set of social actions that are tied to it. So, you know, in that sense, that's always been the problem with the Adorno critique, is that it ties the question of subversion to a particular formal structure of autonomous art, when what you see going on in the social movements is something different.
And the question is, you can have, you know, the art can be subversive as it wants to be, but it's still within the art world. It's still, you know, it's still within in the mainstream institution. You know, the situationist wanted to blow up the wall of the gallery, you know, because this would, you know, symbolically let people in and so forth. But they were still going into the gallery, and they were still not letting the art out, you know. So it's more the way that these distinctions are made, that you know, we accept, you know, unconsciously accept these kinds of distinctions. And of course, as you know, at the Free for All exhibit, I have to say this is kind of indicative. There were three or four quote-unquote real artists, professional artists invited to show their stuff as well. And the thing that people observed is, after a while, you couldn't really tell. Because, you know, you see all this stuff together and you lose your sense of distinction, you know? I'm not sure if that's good. It's like when you go to it and you're, okay, yeah. Go ahead.
That's fine. I was trying to get you off. I just have a comment and a question. My comment is about the stuff in the presentation about the UV and the way that these students were, or the culture is being reflected. My grandfather was on the U of A Senate in the early 60s, and he was a farmer from Red Deer. And he told me several times about, you know, some of this, what happened and why he was asked to be on and so forth. And there was a real movement. Henry Marshall Torrey said the University of Alberta will help to lift the people, or I don't remember, he had some pithy phrase the U of A liked to use a few years ago in a lot of their literature. And there was this very intentional attempt to connect the rural, normal Albertan, or whatever you would like to call that, with the university and with what it was doing. And my grandfather's told me quite a few stories about how they were given stuff to read to try to help think of what would their neighbors want out of the university and how would that look. And that quote that you said, I don't know if a normal person would say this, we've done our fields are now in order, let's go cultivate higher culture. That's exactly the kind of thing they were talking about. And he had a grade 8 education from a school by Penhold, but he was on the U of A Senate, which now wouldn't happen. You wouldn't get someone with a grade 8 education on the U of A Senate anymore. And I'm not saying that that's a good or a bad thing, but there's been this definite transition, and the mandate that they were given as U of A senators was very definitely about connecting university with the average person across the province. And so that was just when I was watching, listening to you, I was thinking about that and thinking that was really the kind of thing he talked about. So it was something that you wouldn't expect maybe to hear, but it was, at least that's the way he talked. My question is just, sorry, about your comments about art in terms of it not being a public space. Can you reflect on the parallels between that and auditory arts, which there is more public space for, particularly, well, there's the Fringe, obviously, which is anybody can go in the Fringe, and that's sort of a large part of their point, their mission. And similarly with music, you comment on the folk festival, I can see that, but there are also a lot of other places where there are open stages and so on and so forth. So can you comment about your reflections on the visual arts and how that compares with the space for auditory arts or for music?
Yeah, it's they're same patterns, and again, what has the difference between the official institutions, the great monoliths and so forth, whether they're physical or ideological. And this is back to why I'm really interested in art in transitory spaces, because of, and you mentioned the Strathcona Art Walk, and there's the Works. There are those, the Empress Ale House, which has, people come in on Saturday afternoons, and of course the folk clubs and so on. And of course it's going on all over. And the Fringe, it's the difference between, is art entertainment, and this is what really comes out in the debate about the art gallery, is it another form of entertainment, like this is great, we have one more thing to do besides go to the hockey game or the theater, or does it have some more enduring purpose of comforting the afflicted and afflicted the comfortable, which it's supposed to be doing, whether you like it or not. And, of course, it's both, But so you have that debate at the Fringe as well, because you so many people coming out, but very few people actually go to the plays. And most people are there to eat the food and listen to the free music, and comparatively few people. The beer tent, and the folk fest. I've never seen you at the Fringe at the beer tent. That would be the folk fest. Where I go to the folk fest because that's where I see all my extended family and friends once a year at the beer tent, yes. But anyway, we're all really there for the music, but I'm sorry, I don't want to get off the track. But of course there are venues, but the most interesting ones are ones, I'm interested in, again, spontaneous venues. The Works is very popular. And again, there's all kinds of, discourse around that, about it being for everybody and not for the hoity-toity wine and cheesers. Again, we have a hard time studying these things, because are the people that are looking at art and Works, are they out there because they really went out there to look at visual art or to listen to music at the folk festival? A lot of people go to the folk festival to party, they go to the Fringe to party, they go shopping and they run into some art in Manulife Center. And, and that's great, because you should be able to do all those things and have art and music integrated into your everyday life, right? So it's more the way the powers that be kind of shape access and interest, and whether we associate ourselves as being just consumers or as also being producers of culture. So I don't know if that answers your question.
And well, just to add to that, ultimately what you're talking about is sort of this goes back to this high culture, low culture, mass culture binary, right? That it's an either or. And I think you're right that high art has had a stronger hold on high culture. I think that certainly you're talking about, music, that's loosened up probably first of all of the, things that were in the clutches of the elites, cultural elites, and certainly music, probably the popular music. That's when Adorno was, actually talking about jazz as being, a mass culture, and now we kind of think of jazz as a much more high kind of culture thing in terms of popular music or rock and roll, right? So I think music's kind of loosened up more over the century, now into the new century, theater probably next, but certainly the visual culture. And then I think the interesting thing in this sort of new era, and particularly for the internet, is photography. I think photography is one thing that's really moved, especially with Flickr sites and things, where people, are showing off their photographs. We have a whole, and people are like, wow, look at those wonderful images, right? Like, people are almost becoming, so I think there's more space in high, but these sort of high visual cultures, probably the, as you say, the last, it's the last one of the, in the high culture classification that hasn't slipped over into the low culture, onto the side of low culture and then kind of been redeemed. It's probably, held on a little more strongly the way it's been structured. And I guess it's also the way it's been funded, the way it's been structured, in terms of criticism and stuff too, right?
But then there's also, there's also the, you know, work of art needs of mechanical reproduction factor where, you know, high art actually is out there in the same image bank with, you know, all those other things. And how do you, and you know, it does undermine the value system, at least at some point. And why should I pay $12 to go see Goya at the, when I can just see it online anytime I want?
And just alongside the discussion we're having, it is there has been a strong urge apparently on the part of the city to integrate literature and more specifically poetry into the daily lives of Edmontonians. As you know, some poems were posted, have been posted on steel lamps alongside the promenade at Louis McKinney Park. And so there is an explicit, you know, effort and urge to just make Edmontonians appreciate poetry and just when they're going in summertime for a walk alongside River Valley, you know, they can read these poems and they can think about poetry, and I think that's phenomenal.
And the poetry slams and poetry nights and the stroll of poets, festival of poetry.
Poetry, yeah.
Can I pipe in with just a comment about reproduction and public space? Because you know, after you mentioned the Benjamin and you're talking about bits of poems being posted up here and there. And I remember the one slide you showed had somebody's sort of fan art picture of house. And I'm wondering, you know, I guess I want to ask a question about, you know, where is the public space now that reproduction is de facto subversive because it is criminal, right? It's an intellectual property violation now, right? And it's being enforced on such a variety of fronts that, you know, the ability to actually populate public space, however that's defined. I'm not actually sure there is any public space, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I just want to throw that wrinkle in there.
Yeah.
So, I think the criminalization of reproduction has a lot of resonance for a lot of the stuff that people are doing as kind of everyday creativity, because a lot of the kind of fan-generated stuff has already been, you know, prosecuted. And for it to be, in a gallery space like that, you got to wonder, you know, like the way we were sort of wary of showing movies in class, you know, mm-hmm. It's just somebody whose relative works in Hollywood and is going to send a lawyer our way.
The same impulse, you know, the plagiarism, you know, we have so much trouble with plagiarism because it's almost as though the concept doesn't exist anymore. I mean, if that stuff's out there, then it must be free, you know, and... Yeah, I mean, it loses its aura in one way. You know, it's even possible for anything to have an aura in that ritualistic way anymore. But so I'm looking at things that, you know, people make kind of in passing as a kind of ritual that you know, those do have auras. And there can't be anything else like it because that piece of junk wasn't lying in your... That bunny was at Ninda's house, you know. It wasn't at your house. That's where I got it.
Thanks. That actually clarifies the parameters for some of the last things you were showing, because I was getting a little lost.
Yeah,
there are so many different things being shown, so you're actually looking for sort of not just transient, but sort of individualized, one-off, right, and therefore kind of erratic sort of installations or events. So.
Things that I really view as, you know, I've been going to pilgrimage places with my rig grant for the past 2 years. And, you know, those installations, but people make these little, you know, little altars. And I mean, I see those things as very ritualistic, very erratic. And it doesn't matter what they are, they're media. You know, the thing is a medium for some kind of, you know, getting back to that aura in a society where everything, you know, it seems kind of ephemeral. But, and I was thinking about fan, what's it called, the literature? Slash fiction, yeah. And some of that gets sued and some of it doesn't. And where's the distinction? You know, you see Mona Lisa's with the mustache on it. And maybe Duchamp made it, you know, or maybe your kid made it and he gets sued because, you know, he took it off the internet.
This is just more of a comment, but some of the comments, other comments came out. I couldn't help but think of Facebook and the walls that people adorn with the pictures, and to what extent, and even, you know, some of the images you showed with, you know, decorated window fronts, you know, how much of that decoration is a kind of a communicative social act, and you know, with Facebook as a social networking site, is there kind of some kind of convergence, or has that always been just some thoughts on Facebook and walls and how people are using that?
Yeah, that's I'm looking, I guess, maybe from the Habermas kind of tradition of communication being either rational, purposive, or whatever else it is, communicative. I can't remember its exact term, sorry. But, you know, it either has one of those two functions. And, yeah, and Facebook being, you know, as I was saying, I'd like to look at, I don't want to say real world, but material world versions of Facebook. What are, you know, now that people are, you know, used to that, and the place to get out, as you're saying, you know, someone is saying, you know, all your photos, you can find out that little did you know your friend is a brilliant photographer. You would never have known that, because every time he said, you want to come over and see my vacation shots, he said, oh, you know, I'm really busy tonight. But, you know, I'm sorry, I'm kind of drifting, I think, from your point.
I wanted to throw some sort of spanner in the works, but, you know, as the anthropologist sitting in the room, about this whole notion of art versus craft. You know, I always have a real hard time with the word art, because I can't figure out kind for myself what makes it art versus some sort of creative adornment of a utilitarian thing with form following function and some cultural parameters for what makes nice decoration on it. Or also I get tangled up with notions of aesthetics. So anyway, I don't know where you might want to go with that, but I have trouble bounding art, I guess is what I would say.
Yes, you and people that have written 5 million books, I think, on this exact topic, you know. And I think it comes down to art is whatever's useless, and the rest is craft. You know, I mean, it's more or less one of the.
But then you get Northwest Coast masks and things which had absolute utility in their context and still do.
Yes.
But you get people who are outside that context looking at them with no knowledge of what their iconography really is and calling it art and sticking it in the art museum in New York and stuff like that. And I get confused with that sort of stuff about, you know, how do you look at these things with no sense of their context and then define art? Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to get exercised there.
Well, that's reception, Leslie, right? I mean, that's the difference. I mean, when we simply study text, if you want to call it that way, I mean, that's reception. Of course, there's no right or wrong, right? I mean, you can try to have guidelines and have an aesthetic system that says this, but that meaning, in terms of the production of meaning, right? I mean, the person looking at the West Coast art in a gallery, when in fact it's pure, it has this incredible ritualistic functional form. Those meanings, I mean, are they right or wrong? But I don't think we could say that they're wrong, they don't understand, and in fact, I find it, you know, once I learned more about Aboriginal culture, it changed the way I viewed it, right? So I think it's the way that meaning gets produced, and you can't, basically, the instability of meaning, right? The production of meaning, you can't tie it down to the text. It can never, there's always that slippery production of, you know, what is it art, is it craft, is it, you know, is it good art, is it not good art, which is where Angela started, right?
Yeah, and it has to do, the cultural production has to do with who gets to say, right, and who gets to say this is what this mask means as opposed to, you know, and so on, you know, and so, and who gets to say
that? Back intellectual property there in terms of the Northwest Coast stuff.
Well, I know, but you're all. But it's true that even, you know, Western European, you know, fine art, high art, whatever you want to call it, is it's out of its context as well. A lot of it, you know. So when something's out of its context, it's lost its original use, and then it becomes art. It becomes art because we define the culture as being irrelevant, right? The uses in the original culture as being essentially irrelevant to us today. So the relics of the culture that aren't being used become art. The icons, the religious paintings that were part of, you know, when Roman Catholic culture had a monopoly of knowledge, are now outside that, and they're just aren't. They're no longer veneration. So it's the same kind of pattern, I think.
Well, I guess it kind of explains why we've got so many theories of art. I mean, is it good art because the critic says so? Is it good art because beauty is in the eye of the beholder? Is it good art because it's hanging in a museum? You know, I mean, all of those things. I mean, and still there was still that distinction about what you were talking about when you're talking about art versus craft. We're still not addressing the question of whether or not it's good art, right?
I mean, that's why I think you slip into this kind of what I always consider kind of this Foucauldian positivism that you get with, you know, that it's all who gets to speak, it's all trained down to the discursive level. I think there is good art.
Yeah.
And I think there is something called the aesthetic. I mean, it's cross-cultural and it's context-laden, but otherwise you get into a relativism where no meaning can be generated even cross-culturally in terms of understanding what gets produced in those cultures, because you've relativized it all to the context of whatever goes and whoever has power. And I think there's a slippage there that's really problematic.
Yes, of course. And I'm trying really hard not to get into that, of course, because, you know, I'm too young to die, really. I mean,
I think we should get into that over some beer.
This needs beer. Because, you know, I spent years and years doing art theory in art school, and I'm telling you, I went to the BAMP school one summer to study after spending, you know, years in Toronto doing weird video experimental technical art, and everybody's at the BAMP school painting mountains like zombies. I hate landscapes. I'm just going to keep painting. I don't know why I'm doing this, you know, but I mean, the same thing, you know. Well, I would just say, actually, I'm very interested in craft. I think these last things, I always go to the craft museums, I never go to the art museums, but, you know, I grew up in a, you know, long generations of peasant farmers, you know, and craftspeople that just made everything because they were broke, they were poor, they could, you know, and they had these skills. They made all the furniture and the clothes and canvas and everything. They thought it was the 19th century. Mom, it's actually 1963. No. But anyway, so my parents, grade 8 education, my dad's in the military because it's the only job he can get me, he's a Mennonite colony, you know, absolutely never seen an actual painting, and I never saw an actual painting until I left home and moved to, you know, somewhere. But my parents we lived in Europe when I was younger because my dad was on a military tour there with NATO, and my parents, who had zero education in almost everything, went to all of the art outlets everywhere we went and bought art books to bring home. And they got all the good stuff. They didn't get any crap at all. They just got the best stuff. And nobody told them. They just said, this is good. Our kids should grow up looking at this. You know? So, and I just tell you the story because I think there's a million people exactly like me growing up way out in the bush somewhere looking at pictures of art and going, holy man, maybe I could be one of these, when everyone else is saying, no, you can be a nurse or a teacher, you know. So, I mean, that's kind of where the impulse for all this is coming from, because, you know, we all know people are out there just creating their heads off, and I want to see it. I want to see that stuff. Anyway, perhaps we could adjourn and move to martinis.
Yeah, good show. Thanks so much, Karen.
I'm sorry I went on a bit. I could have gone on for several hours more. Bad policy. Well, thank you.
And I'm seriously interested in the arts craft thing because, yeah, for me, I'm really into form, follow, and function. Yeah. And the aesthetics of beautiful and functional form is it's all about our society,
this is The rabbit migrated. It's all over it. I actually have a lot of pictures of that rabbit. That people made. And no one really has a
Thanks for coming.
Martini. It's just across the street and about halfway down the next block. You know where the 9th Street Bistro is? Yeah, it's right next to that. It's kind of part of the same.
I'll let this recording in. This is all still recording. I'm going to turn it off. Stop recording.
Okay.